Welcome to Strange Fruit. I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story.
And we have a very exciting show for you all today. Later today, we'll talk to Tania Sanders, who's venturing out on tour to promote her new song. We'll also speak about the I word, illegal versus undocumented, and the immigration debate.
Which was a great conversation.
But first, let's get to our version of Hot Topics, which we call Juicy Fruit.
Yes.
There are a couple of items in the news this week that we were particularly inspired by. So let's start with the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And so, as some of you all probably know, from Monday's Courier Journal here in Louisville, Archbishop Joseph Kurtz has endorsed a local chapter of an organization that promotes chastity and, if you will, abstention among gays and lesbians. The group is called Courage.
It's called Courage, yeah.
And it initially came out of...
I don't know why.
You don't know why it's called Courage.
I guess it takes courage to be abstinent.
And so usually, I guess the way it's set up is that the chapters have... usually between 5 and 10 members, most of the time they're male members, and they kind of have these confidential discussions. And so essentially it follows a 12-step program. And so what is the church's position on this particular?
They say that what's critical to the Courage approach is that Courage, this particular chapter, views the homosexual orientation as a defect and as a burden rather than as a gift to be embraced and as an integral part of someone's personality.
So that's a quote.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, what do you think?
Well, you know what I think.
But tell us what you think. First of all, just talk about perhaps the history of conversion therapy and kind of reparative therapy and what that whole concept is about and that, because it's been going on for a while.
Yes. Reparative therapy has been going on probably, I'd say, since the early 1950s when it comes to the idea of same-sex attraction. And for many LGBT individuals, what would happen is if they came out in any type of way and they were still financially dependent on their folks, parents, parental figures, they would be put in different psychological programs to, make them un-gay or somehow deplete their desire. And one of the main tenets of that, it was remaining abstinent. So they used a variety of techniques.
And that was on the mild end. On the more extreme end, it was castration. Lobotomies.
Yes.
It was like shock therapy.
Yes.
I mean, that's, yeah.
And up until, I'd say, probably the middle 70s, homosexuality, which is the term that comes out of medical research to point out deviance and abnormality when it comes to same-sex attraction. So I never use homosexual. It's a problematic and antiquated term. It's almost like using colored or Negro. That's a side note. But it was still in the DSM-4
as a mental illness
and disorder. And so the profession and or discipline of psychology still, not now, but at one point in time regarded it as a mental defect. And sometimes I think that these programs kind of use the social psycho language, right? Homosexuality and stress those main points that they, stressed back then. So, I mean, not only is it problematic, I mean, especially in light of California outlawing these types of therapies.
Just a couple months ago.
And for our Archbishop to support this type of program and this type of endeavor really just shows how out of touch, I think, the Catholic Church is with the reality of day-to-day human beings, including people who consider themselves Catholic.
The Courage Journal also spoke to our friend and colleague, Chris Hartman, who's director of the Fairness Campaign.
Hey, Chris.
And Chris and I, of course, went to Catholic school together. We're both Catholic. We're both confirmed Catholics. And so we share an experience as Catholic youth. But so Chris says, and it's a quote from Chris, he said, "It's repressive and really unhealthy for people who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. It's unhealthy to suggest that one can suppress an entire part of who they are." And, he's right. He says that too often LGBT folks are being told that we're less than. Mm-hmm. I do want to point out, of course, that this kind of perspective is not exclusive to the Catholic Church by any means. Certainly, if anything, they get credit for it for being very straight up upfront with it, right? Because certainly this happens in Baptist churches, happens in Protestant churches, it happens in apostolic churches. And I think that sometimes the Catholics do get a lot of the blame. But at the same time, they're very unapologetic about their perspective. Mm-hmm. And so whereas you can be a Baptist or a Protestant of some sort and have an affirming minister or go to an affirming church, just as a general rule, if you're Catholic, you're anti-gay.
And then people are like, you know, you can't say anything about it because it's like, ooh, but you're going to talk about the church. And you're just like, well, it's like they're talking about me. I'm not interested.
Tell me how you really feel. No. So, but anyway, we digress. The other juicy fruit we have for this week, you've probably heard about it. You've probably seen it on your gossip websites. It actually has some Kentucky roots. There was recently posted on YouTube a video that's considered the Kappa Gay Wedding, where two black men from Lexington, Kentucky, one of whom is a member of Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity, which is a traditionally black fraternity, they got married. And so they posted their it's really an adorable video on YouTube celebrating their wedding with wedding photos, friends and family. And so there was all this outrage, especially from black folks, because number one, it's been dubbed the gay Kappa wedding because one of the grooms is a member of Kappa. And then their wedding colors were red and white, which are similar to Kappa's colors. And so they have been doing like the national media circuit talking about this gay wedding. So why do you think there's been so much outrage? And
I mean, I don't
sensationalism
know.
about it. Do you think it's still taboo to be black and Greek and gay? I mean, a few years ago, there was a panel that was put on by the Zetas at U of L about being gay and being Greek and being black. Do you think there's still a taboo, or do you think that they're like?
I think that there is this idea still within a lot of black communities, whether they're out as queer LGBT and they have letters, you know, and they consider themselves Greek. I think that there's always a constant silence around, one, Greek life, right? Black Greek life, right? There's
very secretive.
Yeah,
very
it's a secretive
kind of
and covetous.
Mysterious. And, yeah.
And then also the politics of respectability, I feel like, are at play here, right? Because everybody knows that, you know, these organizations, so you're telling me that there have been no gay members of Kappa Alpha Psi, that there have been no gay members of Alpha Phi Alpha? I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. And one, there's, I think that the secrecy has a lot to do with the fact that, one, society looks at LGBT people as hypersexed. Two, society looks at black people as hypersexed. You know, and three, there is a lot of demonization of frat culture, right? Especially with the hazing stuff going on, the binge drinking, all of these things that are already associated with frat life. And so now that society has these awful ideas about black people, around gay people, around frat culture, of course they want to maintain this silence and covetousness around black gay Greeks, right, as if they don't exist. And that somehow these two men who got married in a loving ceremony were somehow disgracing the letters. And that's not the vision of these black organizations. These black organizations were founded on principles of social organization for the betterment of black communities. And this video and this wedding, to me, is about that. It's about them, two black men in America, celebrating their love for one another. I felt like it was an inspiring, great political act.
But I will point out, I think that some of the outrage was that some of Nathaniel Gay's frat brothers were there in support. I think it's wonderful. I give mad props to both Robert and Nathaniel. And I also you have to point out the homoerotic nature of black Greek letter organizations, right? So you talk about the whole pledging process, and I think that the organizations themselves are very homoerotic, and which is indicative of hip hop culture and black masculine culture anyway, from hip hop videos to gang culture. A lot of it is very
to prison
at the same time. Yeah, at the same time, it's very homophobic. It's also very homoerotic.
Oh, definitely. Well, it's the homoeroticism that that makes the individuals a part of these organizations want to suppress the members that are out and gay and comfortable. Yeah, yeah. They want to suppress that because they know it's a homosocial and homoerotic situation. I mean, these are same sex oriented organizations that are valuing time spending with only that same sex, mm-hmm. right?
I do want to give a special shout out to Robert Brown, Nathaniel Gay in Lexington, yes. Kentucky. Hopefully one day they can join us here on the show.
And congratulations, y'all, on your nuptials.
Immigration policy played a big role in this week's presidential debate. We talked with Karen Lopez,
UofL student and member of the Kentucky Dream Coalition,
and Tiff Gonzalez,
immigrant rights activist,
about what the candidates said, how they said it, and about the effects of the I word, illegal.
What did you think of Romney's use of the term illegal, right, versus Obama's use of the term undocumented? And how do you think that the language that we use plays into the way in which people are treated in our country?
I think that Romney's use of the word illegal shows the direction he's going with as far as politics and in the future. It makes me feel uncertain about where our country is heading, especially myself being undocumented, because just hearing his past comments about vetoing the DREAM Act, I feel that he still hasn't adjusted to what students like myself are actually, he still doesn't see us as human beings by using the word illegal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that when you use the word illegal, you have made a determination about somebody's status. You've essentially convicted them of something. And I think it's for somebody who's seeking that high office to criminalize people, it should be concerning mm-hmm. for everybody.
Now, what did you guys think about when Romney said, so long as quote-unquote illegals were upstanding citizens and were college-bound. I think he was actually referring to white immigrants. I mean, he mentioned Welsh and all of these, you know, kind of European nations when he was talking about it. So certainly even Romney's idea of a good, right, illegal, quote-unquote.
When he said that, I kind of just laughed because he said they need to do it the right way, but there is no way. I don't think he realizes that, for example, my family's been doing it the right way for 17 years now. We actually do have a petition, but Obama brought up, you know, it is a broken system that we need to fix first. And I just think that Romney's idea of doing it the right way is kind of making people like myself who were brought to this country at a young age kind of feel like, well, we did something wrong where we just kind of followed our parents and now we're here and we're in a situation that it's not the best situation to be in. And all we want to do is fit in to the country that we grew up in and feel like we are part of America.
Mm. Who is the good, quote unquote, illegal, right? Like who mm-hmm. is the good immigrant? When folks use the term in that way, it's always racist. That is to say that we, you know, he wants to paint a picture of these are the people that we would deem acceptable to be among us who are, right, not us, right? But they're more like us and therefore more acceptable. And it certainly is negating people's human dignity to value some people over others in really in a racist and classist way.
I'm very curious to hear from you, Karen, more about the undocumented experience, right? So as a Black man in America, I know what it's like to feel like an outsider, to be very much aware of police presence and how I'm perceived by others. But could you maybe walk me through how it feels? Does one live in fear forever? Are there ways to kind of circumvent the system? How does one navigate life as someone who's undocumented?
I think that you have to figure it out on your own, kind of, because everybody's situation is very different. For myself, I've been in this situation since I was brought here, 5 years old. And so I didn't really understand my status till I was maybe 16, trying to apply for a driver's license and also trying to apply for colleges and being rejected. My scholarships were being rejected. And I was asking, well, I'm doing as good as my classmates, then why are my scholarships and my financial aid being rejected? And as far as like living in fear, I was always afraid to go to my counselors and tell them my situation coming from a rural community here in Kentucky. And also I didn't want to tell my friends because I felt shame because I heard the word illegal. I didn't I could not relate to the word mm-hmm. illegal. So I never saw myself as an illegal person. And I felt like if I had to explain it to my friends, they would automatically say, oh, you're here illegal. And to me, that was just very shameful. So I decided not to even tell my friends. And then it wasn't till college, till I started becoming involved with the Kentucky Dream Coalition, that I realized there's other students like myself that are in the same situation. And they're not illegal. They're human beings. Yeah. They're just as goofy and outgoing and funny as like anybody else.
I think there's a big need for us to work in coalition around this issue. I think that there are far too few Black voices, African-American voices speaking about immigration. And for me, as I mentioned before to you, Karen, as someone who's been Black in America, so long before immigration was a hot topic, it was driving while Black.
Right. Yep.
It was stop and frisk.
Yes.
You know, it was the criminalization of Black youth. And so it really kind of surprises me how few Black folk can connect these issues. You know, don't believe the hype, don't drink the juice, and understand that the same thing they're doing to our brown brothers and sisters, they've been doing to us.
Well, and like, you know, I think the question for us, like, not, you know, just here in Louisville, but elsewhere, just like any of our other social justice movement building work, right? It's the foundation first is about building relationships, right? And so I do think in order to get to that place where we can be unified and in efforts to resist or reject policies and practices that are going on in our community or around the country, I do think we have to know each other in order to kind of build that strong movement. And so I'm hopeful that there will be more opportunities for that across all kinds of lines, Black and brown and like, you know, queer and undocumented, right? Like all of in all of those spaces, I'm hopeful that we can be more intentional about that.
Is it fair to say si se puede? You know, together we can do it. So thank you both so much for being.
Thank you, Jason and Kyla.
Thank you.
Tania Sanders is a singer-songwriter originally from Jackson, Mississippi. Early in her music career, she lived and played in Louisville, and next week, her tour will bring her back to town. We spoke to Tania about how her intersecting identities influenced her art.
You're heading out on tour now, right?
I am. I'm headed out on the road. I'm headed out today, and then I'll go to Santa Fe and stay there tonight. And then my first show is in St. Louis on Wednesday.
Oh, how exciting.
Will this be a Midwest tour, or are you going to be doing the entire nation, or tell us what you have in store?
I'm just mostly doing the Midwest and a little bit of the South.
Okay. Well, our show here speaks to issues of intersecting identities and how race meets sexuality, meets class, meets whatever identities we have. Can you just kind of self-identify for us and our listeners? What is your self-identity in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I would guess I would identify as bisexual. Okay. I've dated both men and women, and I've had great relationships in both. You know, my last relationship was with a beautiful woman, and that was a really great 3.5 years of my life. So being from the South was a very interesting thing, being a bisexual person. And let alone that, dating outside of my race was huge there. So I dealt with a lot of conflict in that aspect of being kind of the black sheep of the South, so to speak, because I was a lot different.
How do those things influence your music? I know that you consider yourself to be, I made a few notes here, a folk soul singer. How do those things influence the music that you make and the music that you write? Your experiences both as a Southerner, as a person who's dated interracially, as someone who's dated both men and women, do those things inform your music?
Yeah, they definitely do. As a musician, first and foremost, I just go for the heart. Like everything for me is pretty much heart-centered. So all the music I write are stories, either if they're not my story, they're somebody's story. And I just like to take my Southern roots, which is I love the blues and I love gospel and I love the foundation of that, but I also love country. And so, you know, folk is the storyteller part, and it's how you tell the story and really get people intrigued enough to listen the whole way through. And the soul part is just really touching their hearts while you're doing it. And so that's how it's affected me, because I grew up with these strong roots of, you know, in the South, everybody is there. They want to give you a hug. They want to feed you. They want to take care of you. And that's the soul part in me. And the folk part is just telling the story.
How did you get to incorporate all those different
types of musical genres within you as an artist, right? Because at first you start off singing gospel and doing singing in choirs too. Can you just like talk to a little bit about the evolution of yourself as an artist to the particular genres of music?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. I grew up singing in church, of course, because if you live in the South, that's what you do. You go to church. Mm-hmm. There's not much else to do if I go to church. So I grew up singing in the church, and then I went from that. I was in choir, and so we did a lot of classical pieces. We did a lot of contemporary pieces as well. And so I kind of found my voice in that, like really learned these different styles, not just R&B and gospel. And so I learned how to sing classical music. And I started writing at such a young age that it became this thing of what kind of melodies I wanted to use, what does the song really need. I always call them downloads. Songs are downloads for me. But I went from that to really fall in love with country from the storytelling part, probably about 18. So I picked up guitar around that age and just started blending everything. So everything I learned kind of came into play by 18. And then I kind of began to find my voice around 22 or so. And so it just all kind of went from there. I think it's ever-changing for me because I never stay in one place for too long musically. I like to hang out in different places, but I never want to stay for very long. So I just kind of do whatever I feel. And that's just kind of how it's come about from Soulcatcher 2007 to Confessions of a Scorpio, which has a really funky edge to it, full band. To now my new single that is pretty pop reggae.
What, speaking of your new single, is that Radioactive Lover?
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a quick moment and listen to that. But before we listen to it, just describe for us what we're about to hear and what Radioactive Lover is all about.
Okay, Radioactive Lover, I collaborated with a great, talented producer here in Phoenix named Johnny O. And we just took this song that was kind of a rootsy pop song and made it into this reggae / hip-hop old-school Motown throwback. So, yeah, it's just a fun tune. That's what we wanted to create, something fun and something meaningful and full of love.
All right, let's take a listen.
Hey, baby, I love you like you really, really want me to. And I leave it on the front line. You live there all the time. Me, I leave it on the bed, please. Yeah, baby, this is so sweet. Our love.
All right, so that was Radioactive Lover by Tinia Sanders. And you are right, that song has a really cool feel, a really cool vibe. Earlier we were watching the video on YouTube, and we love the black and white effect. And it really was a kind of an homage or throwback to Motown and reggae. And it was really, really a fun song. Did you have fun making that video, and did you have fun writing that song?
I did. I did all the choreography, mostly all of the staging with the director, Chris Lavity. And I just had a blast because it gave me the opportunity to use my creativity, not just with the song, to use it with everything else, with the dance and the costumes and using these different characters. So I had a blast. Like, it's my, I think, the most fun I've had yet.
Well, that's cool. And speaking of fun, another, I guess, probably, if I were in your shoes, another kind of shiny moment would be when you were asked to be a part of the soundtrack for a Morgan Freeman movie. He did the movie Prom Night, about throwing the first integrated prom in the city where he's from in Mississippi. And I know that you were asked to be a part of that soundtrack, and you had a song, was it called Stand? Is that right?
Yeah, it's called Stand.
Tell us all about what was that like?
A friend of mine, Tavi Moyo, was working on the film, and she just happened to be playing a CD of mine. It was a live CD. I never released it. In the car with the director, Paul Sodman. And he said, "Who is this?" She said, "It's my friend, Tania." He said, "Oh, my God, I love her voice. Do you think she would come in and sing some spirituals?" Because the documentary is broken into two parts, Return to Mississippi and Prom Night in Mississippi. She said, "I don't know why I asked." So I decided, yeah, I'd love to, but I would like to write something. And they liked the song enough that they wanted to use it. And then the documentary got picked up by HBO. So it's really thrilling because it's back to my roots in Mississippi and using a song like that to really express how I felt. And I know how a lot of people feel about racism and segregation and, you know, almost always not feeling good enough and somebody throwing something in your face that isn't really valuable in the first place.
Mm. Okay.
Tania, thanks so much for joining us. Listen, safe travels on the road, and we wish you all the success in the world. And we look forward to meeting you in person when you come back to Louisville, okay?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you guys for the interview. I can't wait to see you.
That was Tania Sanders. Tania will be performing this Thursday night, October 25th, at Zanzibar at 8:30. So we'll post the details on Facebook. And, of course, for full disclosure, our lovely producer, Laura Ellis, is performing that night as well with the opening band. So we had a very, very cool show today. We talked to Tania. We talked to Tiff and Karen about the immigration issue. You got some reflections on today's episode?
Yes, I loved our episode this week. I felt like I learned a lot from Tiff and Karen. I felt like I learned a lot about an undocumented experience, a lot about what happens to one when one has multiple intersecting identities and one of those identities might be citizenship, right? And how severe that is. I loved talking to Tania about her tour and all of her songs and, you know, her contribution, you know, as a queer, you know, artist. And I really love the show.
What? One common theme I saw throughout both speaking to Tania and speaking with our guests on the immigration debate was the concept of self-identification and how important words can be. And for example, Tania describes her music as folk soul, right? So mm-hmm. as a Black woman who does her genre of music, is she country? Is she rock? Is she folk? Is she R&B? What is she? And so it was very important for her to self-describe her style of music. Similarly, when it comes to the immigration debate, are they undocumented? Are they illegal? And so I think there really is power in words and how folks choose to self-identify. If there was something I wanted our listeners to take away from this episode, besides supporting, checking out and supporting Tania and learning all about her history and her sound, I do want to encourage more of our African-American listeners to get involved in the immigration debate, to learn more about the issues, to learn more about how the things that are affecting immigrants and Latinos and people from all nations who are caught up in the immigration debate, to understand how those things also used to happen and frankly still do continue to happen to us, and
yeah.
to not to lose sight of that. And so hopefully there'll be a little bit more coalition building and a little bit more community between African-Americans especially and Latinos.
I completely agree with that. I think that it was really, really spot on. You pointing out that it doesn't seem that there's a lot of African-American voices on this issue of immigration and on the issue of citizenship status. And it doesn't make absolutely any sense to me. I see them as completely intersectional.
They are. And yeah, they're very intersectional. So on that note, we'll see you all next time, our little fruit flies.
Yes. Oh, my God. I hate fruit flies. No. But that's cute. Can't they be like Fruit Loops or?
No, there are fruit flies. Gaga has her monsters. Nicki Minaj has her barbs and her Ken barbs. Bieber has his
What are Bieber's called?
Beliebers, exactly.
Beliebers.
And so strange fruit, we have our fruit flies.
Okay.
Strange Fruit is produced by 89.3 WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis.
We had additional assistance this week from Erica Peterson.
The views we and our guests express on Strange Fruit don't reflect those of WFPL, Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
For more information on Strange Fruit, go to WFPL.org, find us on Facebook, or visit us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod. I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story. Thanks for listening.